Oh, you know, he said, as if he'd only been away a few weeks, as if I were a colleague, not his lover, his wife. Oh, you know, the same as always, nothing really new. He drank deeply from his orange juice, really drank to savor it, so that for a minute or two nothing existed in the house but his enjoyment. Then he casually asked about other improvements around the house. After breakfast, we sat on the porch watching the sheets of rain, the puddles collecting in the herb garden. We read for a while, then went back inside and made love. It was a kind of repetitive, trance-like fucking, comfortable only because the weather cocooned us. If I had been pretending up until that point, I couldn't fool myself any longer that my husband was entirely present. Then it was lunch, and then television. I found a rerun of a two-man sailing race for him, and more banal talk. He asked about some of his friends, but I had no answers. I never saw them. They'd never really been my friends. I didn't cultivate friends. I had just inherited them from my husband. We tried to play a board game and laughed at some of the sillier questions. Then weird gaps in his knowledge became apparent, and we stopped, a kind of silence settling over us. He read the paper and caught up on his favorite magazines, watched the news, or perhaps he only pretended to do those things. When the rain stopped, I woke from a brief nap on the couch to find him gone from beside me. I tried not to panic when I checked every room and couldn't find him anywhere. I went outside and eventually found him around the side of the house. He was standing in front of the boat he had bought a few years back, which he could never fit in the garage. It was just a cruiser, about 20 feet long, but he loved it. As I came and curled my arm around his, he had a puzzled, almost forlorn look on his face, as if he could remember that the boat was important to him, but not why. He didn't acknowledge my presence, kept staring at the boat with a growing blank intensity. I could feel him trying to recall something important. I just didn't realize until much later that it had to do with me. That he could have told me something vital then, there, if he could only have recalled what. So we just stood there, and although I could feel the heat and weight of him beside me, the steady sound of his breathing, we were living apart. After a while, I couldn't take it, the sheer, directionless anonymity of his distress, his silence. I led him back inside. He didn't stop me. He didn't protest. He didn't try to look back over his shoulder at the boat. I think that's when I made my decision. If he had only looked back, if he had just resisted me, even for a moment, it might have been different. At dinner, as he was finishing, they came for him in 4 or 5 unmarked cars and a surveillance van. They did not come in rough or shouting, with handcuffs and weapons on display. Instead, they approached him with respect, one might almost say fear, the kind of watchful gentleness you might display if about to handle an unexploded bomb. He went without protest, and I let them take this stranger from my house. I couldn't have stopped them, but I also didn't want to. The last few hours I had coexisted with him in a kind of rising panic, more and more convinced that whatever had happened to him in Area X had turned him into a shell, an automaton going through the motions, someone I had never known. With every atypical act or word, he was driving me further from the memory of the person I had known, and despite everything that had happened, preserving that idea of him was important. That is why I called the special number he had left me for emergencies. I didn't know what to do with him, couldn't coexist with him any longer in this altered state. Seeing him leave, I felt mostly a sense of relief, to be honest, not guilt at betrayal. What else could I have done? As I have said, I visited him in the observation facility right up until the end. Even under hypnosis in those taped interviews, he had nothing new to say, really, unless it was kept from me. I remember mostly the repetitious sadness in his words. I'm walking forever on the path from the border to base camp. It is taking a long time, and I know it will take even longer to get back. There is no one with me. I am all by myself. The trees are not trees, the birds are not birds, and I am not me, but just something that has been walking for a very long time. This was really the only thing I discovered in him after his return, a deep and unending solitude, as if he had been granted a gift that he didn't know what to do with, a gift that was poison to him and eventually killed him. But would it have killed me? That was the question that crept into my mind, even as I stared into his eyes those last few times, willing myself to know his thoughts and failing. As I labored at my increasingly repetitive job in a sterile lab, I kept thinking about Area X and how I would never know what it was like without going there. No one could really tell me, and no account could possibly be a substitute. So several months after my husband died, I volunteered for an Area X expedition. A spouse of a former expedition member had never signed up before. I think they accepted me in part because they wanted to see if that connection might make a difference. I think they accepted me as an experiment. But then again, maybe from the start they expected me to sign up. By morning, it had stopped raining and the sky was a searing blue, almost devoid of clouds. Only the pine needles strewn across the tops of our tents and the dirty puddles and fallen tree limbs on the ground told of the storm the night before. The brightness infecting my senses had spread to my chest. I can describe it no other way. Internally, there was a brightness in me, a kind of prickling energy and anticipation that pushed hard against my lack of sleep. Was this part of the change? But even so, it didn't matter. I had no way to combat what might be happening to me. I also had a decision to make, finding myself torn between the lighthouse and the tower. Some part of the brightness wanted to return to the darkness at once, and the logic of this related to nerve, or lack of it. To plunge right back into the tower, without thought, without planning, would be an act of faith, of sheer resolve, or recklessness with nothing else behind it. But now I also knew that someone had been in the lighthouse the night before. If the psychologist had sought refuge there, I could track her down. Then I might gain more insight into the tower before exploring it further. This seemed of increasing importance, more so than the night before, because the number of unknowns the tower represented had multiplied tenfold. So by the time I talked to the surveyor, I had decided on the lighthouse. The morning had the scent and feel of a fresh start, but it was not to be. If the surveyor had wanted no part of a return to the tower, then she equally had no interest in the lighthouse. "You don't want to find out if the psychologist is there?" The surveyor gave me a look as if I had said something idiotic. "Hold up in a high position, with clear lines of sight in every direction, in a place they've told us has a weapons cache. I'll take my chances here. If you were smart, you'd do the same. You might find out that you don't like a bullet hole in the head. Besides, she might be somewhere else." Her stubbornness tore at me. I didn't want to split up. For purely practical reasons, it was true we had been told prior expeditions had stored weapons at the lighthouse, and because I believed it more likely that the surveyor would try to go home without me there. "It's the lighthouse or the tower," I said, trying to sidestep the issue. "And it would be better for us if we found the psychologist before we went back down into the tower. She saw whatever killed the anthropologist. She knows more than she's told us." The unspoken thought that perhaps if a day passed or two, whatever lived in the tower, slowly making words on the wall, would have disappeared or gotten so far ahead of us we would never catch up. But that brought to mind a disturbing image of the tower as endless, with infinite levels descending into the earth. The surveyor folded her arms. "You really don't get it, do you? This mission is over." Was she afraid? Did she just not like me enough to say yes? Whatever the reason, her opposition angered me, as did the smug look on her face. In the moment, I did something I regret now. I said, "There's no reward in the risk of going back to the tower right now." I thought I had been subtle in my intonation of one of the psychologist's hypnotic cues, but a shudder passed over the surveyor's face, a kind of temporary disorientation. When it cleared, the look that remained told me she understood what I had tried to do. It wasn't even a look of surprise, more that in her mind I had confirmed an impression of me that had been slowly forming, but was now set. Now, too, I had learned that hypnotic cues only worked for the psychologist.
"You'd do anything, wouldn't you, to get your way?"
the surveyor said. But the fact was, she held the rifle. What weapon did I really have? And I told myself it was because I didn't want the anthropologist's death to be meaningless that I had suggested this course of action. When I did not reply, she sighed, then said, with weariness in her voice,
"You know, I finally figured it out while I was developing those useless photographs. What bothered me the most, it's not the thing in the tunnel or the way you conduct yourself or anything the psychologist did. It's this rifle I'm holding, this damn rifle. I stripped it down to clean it and found it was made of 30-year-old parts cobbled together. Nothing we brought with us is from the present. Not our clothes, not our shoes. It's all old junk, restored crap. We've been living in the past this whole time, in some sort of reenactment. And why?"
She made a derisive sound.
"You don't even know why."
It was as much as she'd ever said to me at one time. I wanted to say that this information registered as little more than the mildest of surprises in the hierarchy of what we had thus far discovered. But I didn't. All I had left was to be succinct. "Will you remain here until I return?" I asked. This was now the essential question, and I didn't like the speed of her reply or its tone.
"Whatever you want."
"Don't say anything you can't back up," I said. I had long ago stopped believing in promises. Biological imperatives, yes. Environmental factors, yes. Promises, no.
"Fuck off," she said.
So that's how we left it. Her leaning back in that rickety chair, holding her assault rifle, as I went off to discover the source of the light I had seen the night before. I had with me a knapsack full of food and water, along with two of the guns, equipment to take samples, and one of the microscopes. Somehow I felt safer taking a microscope with me. Some part of me, too, no matter how hard I tried to convince the surveyor to come with me, welcomed the chance to explore alone, to not be dependent on or worried about anyone else. I looked back a couple of times before the trail twisted away, and the surveyor was still sitting there, staring at me like a distorted reflection of who I'd been just days before. 3. Immolation. Now a strange mood took hold of me as I walked silent and alone through the last of the pines and the cypress knees that seemed to float in the black water, the gray moss that coated everything. It was as if I traveled through the landscape with the sound of an expressive and intense aria playing in my ears. Everything was imbued with emotion, awash in it, and I was no longer a biologist, but somehow the crest of a wave building and building, but never crashing to shore. I saw with such new eyes the subtleties of the transition to the marsh, the salt flats, as the trail became a raised berm, dull, algae-choked lakes spread out to the right, and a canal flanked it to the left. Rough channels of water meandered out in a maze through a forest of reeds on the canal side, and islands, oases of wind-contorted trees, appeared in the distance like sudden revelations. The stooped and blackened appearance of these trees was shocking against the vast and shimmering gold-brown of the reeds.